Hello, welcome to Illinois Radio Reader. This is Lisa with the News Gazette, dated July 8th, 2026. Welcome to today's paper. On the front page is a large picture today of a construction site. It says, construction on new multi-tenant building at 105 East Division Street in Fisher is almost complete, according to developer Abraham Martinez of Topline General Construction of Mahomet. And this is just waiting for the Illinois Department of Transportation to approve a few things. A salon, spa, and liquor store are both set to open in the space within the next few months, Martinez said. The property is a whole, and it will be known as Plaza 136 Story. And that article will appear on later on in the newspaper. At the top of the front page is an article about the World Cup, and it's got the title, Call Her Argentina's Comeback Kid. St. Joe fourth grader might have brought luck from contest win onto the pitch. Argentina has St. Joseph 9-year-old Lucy Messman to thank for its remarkable comeback win in Tuesday's World Cup soccer match against Egypt. At least that's how the fun-loving fourth grader sees it. I must have been the good luck charm, she said. Accompanied by her father, a St. Joseph grade school student, took part in pre-match festivities. In front of 68,239 fans at Atlanta Stadium after winning a contest put on by PepsiCo and Frito-Lay. With Dad watching from the stands, a fully uniformed Lucy walked hand-in-hand to the pitch with Argentina's Enzo Fernandez during player introductions. I was kind of jittery because there were so many people watching, Lucy said. After anthems were played, Lucy and other contest winners changed in the Atlanta Falcons locker room and then watched the match from prime seats. Wouldn't you know, Fernandez scored the game winner in the stoppage time to complete Argentina's epic rally from 2-0 deficit with 11 minutes left. I didn't really know his name, but I knew he must be good if he played on a team with Lionel Messi. On a team in the final 16, Lucy said. When I saw who scored, I said, oh my gosh, I walked out with him. Some 4 hours away in Tybee Island near Savannah, Georgia, Lucy's mom, Sarah, and three siblings were glued to the TV. Lucy and her dad, Jeff, drove there after the match to resume a family vacation, interrupted by a magic, cool, and amazing opportunity, Jeff said. Lucy is smiling from ear to ear and on cloud nine. The Messmans were notified of their contest win in May, about 1 year after they lost their home in St. Joseph to fire. Less than 2 years ago, the family moved into their rebuilt home at the same location. It's been a whirlwind, Sarah said. We're blessed beyond measure. Lucy, part of the Messi fans, even before Tuesday's match, can't wait to share stories when school resumes in August. I'm going to remember this forever. Walking out on the field, the fireworks, the national anthems, she said. It was very exciting. And there's a picture there of Lucy Messman and Argentina's Enzo Fernandez as they walk onto the pitch before Tuesday's World Cup soccer match in Atlanta. How fun for her. Continuing on the front page, an article from Savoy about the Advocates for Aging Care. Nursing home seeks $2.5 million for initial costs. State-issued report on Savoy proposal was very positive by Jana Wiersema. An application by a local nonprofit and its partners to build a new skilled nursing facility in Savoy checks off most of the boxes that the state gave, except for a requirement regarding proof of funding to cover the initial startup costs. We need $2.5 million for what's called working capital, explained Advocates for Aging Care Committee Chair Kathy Emanuel. So it's really the funds that you need when you start up a business for the startup losses until it's fully functional and then to provide cash flow. Because as in a nursing home and many healthcare facilities, you provide the service, you incur the expense, but you don't get the revenue until later. The nonprofit is working to raise these funds and currently has about $750,000 in commitments, she said. Emmanuel added that the nonprofit might be able to get a line of credit and is in talks with a few donors we think are likely to make the commitment to get us closer to that total. "We think we can get there, and it's essential," she said. "We have to raise that $2.5 million. That state's right. We need that working capital." Staff for the Illinois Health Facilities and Service Review Board issued a report Tuesday on Advocates for Aging Care and developer FAPROP LLC's proposed $26.6 million project, which would include 120 beds and be located on 10 acres near the northeast corner of West Church Street and South Mattis Avenue. "We're feeling good because overall the staff report was very positive," Emmanuel said. "So we just have one negative finding and one that we think we can address. It makes us feel positive about it." According to the report from review board staff, there were 908 long-term care LTC beds in Champaign County in 2019, but the number dropped to 411 by 2025 due to multiple facility closures, as well as Clark Lindsay's decision to reduce its number of skilled care beds. State staff wrote that the Champaign County planning area's extreme deficit of 310 long-term care beds limits access to care, delays hospital discharge, and often forces patients to leave Champaign County to find available long-term care beds. Care in the community of choice helps ensure family support of patients residing or otherwise receiving care in an LTC facility, staff wrote. As a general matter, the vast majority of LTC patients are older adults who rely on government insurance programs. Accordingly, the planned Advocates for Aging LTC facility project will play a vital role in reducing health disparities faced by the patients it will serve. Nursing homes support the basic daily needs of the elderly and other disabled individuals, including health, safety, dignity, and emotional and social well-being. The report also found that the project applicants are fit, willing, and able to provide a proper standard of LTC service for the community. The project concept features 10 home-like cottages in a campus residential setting. Per the application to the state, each cottage would include 12 units, with each unit having its own private room and bathroom and common spaces, such as a group dining area, a living area, and outdoor space. Two of the cottages would be located near each other with a rehabilitation area in between, providing therapy to residents who require rehabilitation services. Advocates for Aging Care plan to be the nonprofit operator for the facility and contract Southern Administrative Services to manage the facility, which has been named, the Cottages, according to a previous interview with Emmanuel. Southern Administrative Services and FAPROP are related entities. Plans also include working with Aging Inn to implement the greenhouse model. In addition to the cottage housing style, the approach involves employing certified nursing assistants as universal workers who provide personalized care to residents and handle a variety of tasks, the project application stated. Emmanuel said that the facility is projected to open in the spring of 2028, pending state approval. Staff for the State Review Board noted that 130 individuals registered their attendance at a June 9th public hearing about the project. 126 were in support, 2 were in opposition, and 2 remained neutral, staff wrote. 50 individuals provided oral testimony in support of the project. Comments in response to the state report must be received before 9 a.m. July 13th. The State Review Board is currently scheduled to review the proposed project on July 21st. More information is available at hfsrb.illinois.gov. Advocates for Aging Care hopes to have more funds raised by the board meeting date. Emmanuel told the News Gazette, "The organization hasn't gone to the public with its fundraiser yet, but plans to do so if and when the state approves the requested certificate of need permit. A link to donate can be found at advocatesforagingcare.org. Emmanuel also noted that state legislation has recently passed that creates standards for cottage-style nursing homes. If you need all of the requirements, if you meet all of the requirements, the state reimburses you at a higher level of reimbursement for Medicaid patients. So that will also probably help our situation a little bit, she said, adding that this has been factored into the project's current financial pro forma. Advocates for Aging Care shared in a recent newsletter that organizations who fulfill the law's standards will receive an increase of at least 50% Medicaid resident per day. According to the Review Board staff report, Advocates for Aging Care and its partners are expecting a 50% Medicaid, 50% private pay, and Medicare short stay payer mix at the proposed facility. And the last article on the front page from the Champaign County Court by Luke Taylor with the title, Attempted Murder Charge in Alleged Vehicular Assault. A Champaign woman has been charged with attempted murder after she allegedly ran over another woman with her vehicle on Sunday. Kotia Fairman, 38, appeared in court Tuesday to hear charges of attempted murder, failure to report a crash, and two counts of aggravated battery in connection with the incident. If convicted of attempted homicide, she could face 6 to 30 years in prison, to be followed by 18 months of mandatory supervised release. Failure to report a crash carries a possible sentence of up to 3 to 7 years in prison, and each count of aggravated battery has a possible sentence of up to 30 months of probation. Assistant State's Attorney Eileen Keeley said that Champaign police responded to an address on Bradley Avenue for a report that a woman had been struck by a motor vehicle. Officers found her with an injury to her right foot and blood on her sock. She was transported to an area hospital for treatment. Keeley said that the investigators learned that Fairman and the victim were engaged in an argument leading up to the incident. Surveillance footage obtained by the investigators allegedly shows Fairman driving a gray vehicle toward the victim. The victim's attempts to move out of the vehicle's path, but Fairman appeared to turn onto the sidewalk, striking the victim. Afterward, Keeley said Fairman continues to drive forward over the victim's body. Champaign County Judge Brett Olmsted ruled that Fairman would be detained in the county jail until a further hearing on whether she will continue to be detained all the way through the resolution of her case. Due to high volume of other cases scheduled on Wednesday, that detention hearing was scheduled for Thursday. Fairman is the second individual in around 2 weeks to be charged with attempted murder for allegedly striking another person with a vehicle. Carmen Laws, a 20-year-old Champaign man, faces similar charges in a June 25th incident in which he allegedly tried to run over his girlfriend after a dispute. Laws was also detained and awaits his next court date, a preliminary hearing on July 23rd. Let's continue on to Section A8, Under Our Communities, with an article from Champaign. Champaign-Urbana Public Health District, and it's entitled, Personal Data Potentially Compromised in Cyber Attack, by Jana Wiersema. At the same time, the University of Illinois and thousands of other institutions were dealing with the impacts of a cyber attack on learning management system Canvas, the Champaign-Urbana Public Health District was facing a breach of its own. The health district has shared what a data security event occurred in early May, potentially compromising a variety of personal data points, such as Social Security numbers and financial account information. The health district noticed suspicious activity related to its computer network on or around May 7th, according to a public notice issued through law firm Mullen Coughlin, LLC. In response, CUPHD quickly worked to secure all systems and began an investigation to determine the full nature and scope of the activity, officials said. The investigation determined that between May 6th of 2026 and May 7th, an unauthorized actor copied certain files from our computer network. Following this determination, we began a review to determine what information was present in the affected files and to whom it relates. While the review is still ongoing, the health district believes that the following information may have been present in the compromised files. 1. Names. 2. Addresses. Then birth dates, treatment information, diagnostic information, health insurance information, including policy numbers, social security numbers, and financial account information. Please note the scope of information is expected to vary by individual, officials said. The health district is notifying state and federal regulators of the incident. Officials said additional security measures are being implemented to safeguard against future attacks. The confidentiality, privacy, and security of information is one of CUPHD's highest priorities, and CUPHD takes this matter very seriously, officials said. The announcement noted that individuals who believe their data may have been compromised could order a credit report, a fraud alert, and/or a credit freeze from any of the three major credit reporting bureaus. An article from Danville about the Vermilion County Courts. Danville teacher facing sex abuse charges released ahead of trial by Jennifer Bailey. A Danville high school teacher facing charges of aggravated criminal sexual abuse involving a victim under 18 has been allowed to remain free pending trial. A detention hearing Tuesday morning at the Rita B. Garman Vermilion County Courthouse, Judge Karen Wall granted pretrial release with conditions and a supervision requirement to Jordan Ritchie, 27, who was present with his attorney, Jamie Props. The hearing had been continued from Monday so that Ritchie could obtain private counsel. Ritchie's next hearing was set for July 20th. Ritchie, who also has worked in the high school teachers, was a theater department and was a golf coach, was arrested last week on a warrant charging him with 4 counts of aggravated criminal sexual abuse. Danville police said the investigation remains ongoing. Superintendent John Hart said in an email to families that administrators received allegations of inappropriate conduct regarding Ritchie and notified the police. He said upon learning of the allegations, the district immediately directed Ritchie not to report to work and placed him on administrative leave in accordance with its procedures. Officials with DLO Musical Theater, where Ritchie had also been involved, said in a statement on social media that they received notification of allegations and an investigation from police, and Ritchie was immediately removed from the organization by action of the executive committee. At the request of the Danville Police Department, we made no public comment or acknowledgement of those allegations at the time so as not to interfere with an ongoing investigation, the group stated. DLO Musical Theater's number one priority is the safety and protection of all our cast members and volunteers, particularly the children. As a result, we are constantly reviewing and refining the guidelines and procedures that our volunteers must comply with, the statement said. Currently, background checks are executed on all volunteers that work with children. We provide a space for open rehearsals that any parent can attend, and there are multiple avenues of communication that a cast member can use to register concerns and complaints. Another article from Urbana by Luke Taylor about the U.S. Marshals Service, and the title is Rand Toolman Accused of Threatening Military Personnel, Their Families in Texas. A Rand Toolman has been indicted for allegedly threatening military personnel in Texas. On Tuesday, a grand jury indicted 37-year-old Kevin Baskis on 2 counts of making threatening interstate communications. On June 29th and 30th, Baskis allegedly made phone calls to Fort Bliss in El Paso, Texas, threatening to injure U.S. military personnel and their families. He was arrested July 1st and remains in custody of the U.S. Marshals Service. U.S. Magistrate Judge Eric Long ordered he be detained while awaiting the resolution of his case. If convicted, Vasquez could face up to 5 years in prison, a fine of up to $250,000, up to 3 years of mandatory supervised release, and $100 in special assessment. Continuing on under our communities, an article from Chicago about the online prediction markets. Chicago weighs ban on call sheet and poly market bets for insider city staff by Jake Sheridan. Chicago employees and elected officials could soon be banned from using insider knowledge to place bets on online prediction markets like call sheet and poly market. The gambling-like market soaring in popularity allows users to wager on a huge, diverse, growing number of questions ranging from sports and election outcomes to war, ceasefires, and even local policy. City leaders and staff must be clearly blocked from using their confidential information to place bets, argued the ban's top proponent, Alderman Timmy Knudsen, 43rd. The work that we do within City Hall and within all of our offices is innately sensitive and often confidential, Knudsen said. We just need to be sure that people aren't using any of that information for profit or for playing games. Aldermen advanced Knudsen's measures in a unanimous voice vote Tuesday during a City Council Ethics Committee meeting. It will likely face a final vote next week. Knudsen told the Tribune ahead of the Tuesday vote that city law already blocks elected officials and employees from using insider information to enrich themselves. City attorneys would argue prediction market bets are already against the law if a case went to court, he predicted. But the emerging prediction markets are nonetheless a little bit gray because of a lack of federal regulation, he added. With his proposed ordinance, Knudsen hopes to draw a clear line. Let's head over now to opinions section in A7 with J. Mark Powell's Holy Cow History, where he has a large picture of colorful fireworks as they light up the sky Saturday night during the Sibley area 4th of July celebration. And his article is entitled, How America's First 4th Went Off with a Bang. Throughout history, milestone Independence Day anniversaries have arrived just when Americans needed them most. The nation's centennial in 1876. Take that, for instance. After surviving the bloodiest war in U.S. history in the 1860s, Americans were ready to let their hair down and celebrate. Likewise, the bicentennial in 1976 was the perfect tonic for a nation still reeling from the deep funk caused by the Kennedy assassination, the Vietnam War, and Watergate. Now, folks of all partisan stripes agree that the American spirit in 2026 could use a fresh infusion of the spirit of 76. However, a strong case can be made that the most important, most consequential, and most meaningful of all the preceding 249 anniversaries was the very first. This is the forgotten story of how America marked July 4th, 1777. The American Revolution was in its third year. The fighting that began in April of 1775 at Lexington and Concord in Massachusetts, followed by the Battle of Bunker Hill that June, showed that the plucky patriots could hold their own against a global superpower. After modest successes in early 1776, George Washington's army was driven out of New York City, then, as now, America's commercial capital. The decisive year ended with the capture of a Hessian outpost in Trenton, New Jersey, providing a desperately needed morale boost. Then came a torturous winter and the times that try men's souls, as Thomas Paine so eloquently put it. The mere fact that the 13 colonies had clung together and made it to July of 1777 was reason enough to celebrate. That their ragtime armies were still carrying on the struggle seemed almost miraculous. So, continental leaders made sure that July 4th was a blowout, and their celebrations were remarkably similar to ours today. The biggest bash in 1777 was in Philadelphia, the infant nation's capital. The Declaration of Independence had been signed there, and the Continental Congress still met in its stately Pennsylvania State House. An account published in the Virginia Gazette reported that the City of Brotherly Love went all out, with bell ringing, military parades, concerts, banquets with toasts to America's future, large crowds cheering enthusiastically, and massive bonfires called illuminations. Two-activity artillery salutes and a fireworks display are especially significant. We'll see why in a moment. Likewise, Boston, still joyful after the hated British had evacuated the year before, organized activities all around town, including fireworks and artillery salutes fired over the common. Baltimore, whose port was booming after the fall of New York, held a public reading of the Declaration. It threw a massive public dinner, complete with 13 toasts, one for each of the colonies, followed by military parades and, you guessed it, a 13-gun cannon salute and fireworks. Farther south, Charleston, South Carolina, had a double reason to celebrate. 1 year earlier, its defenders had turned back a British invasion fleet in Charleston Harbor. There were patriotic speeches, special church services, more dinners, more toasts, and the military firing more salutes. Its last attraction, coupled with all the fireworks displays, that's telling. We take annual nighttime pyrotechnic displays for granted. They're lit, they go bang, pretty colors light up the darkness, and the crowd oohs and ahs in unison. But fireworks had additional importance in 1777. They're propelled by gunpowder. After all, not only was gunpowder the lifeblood of the Continental Army, needed for flintlock muskets and cannons, but it was also chronically in short supply. Washington's men often went into early battles with barely enough powder on hand. Getting hold of it was a massive challenge. There were small mills scattered around the colonies in places like Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and elsewhere. British supplies were captured from time to time, although France had yet to ally with patriot cause. It secretly sold us precious powder, though it first had to make the long Atlantic crossing to get here. Little wonder, then, that colonial soldiers were constantly admonished not to waste gunpowder. So why, with that commodity in such perilously short supply, were they burning it up for fireworks displays? Because then, as now, fireworks made a special occasion even more so. Patriot leaders were determined to celebrate the Declaration's first anniversary as a massive show of public faith, a demonstration of their belief that although the war still raged, independence was already a reality, and they were willing to use their scarcest, most precious resource to demonstrate their commitment to that conviction. So when you watch the red, white, and blue balls of fire break through the darkness on the 4th this year, remember that when our founding fathers did it 249 Julys earlier, they were giving evidence not only of their belief that they would succeed, but of their optimism that we would succeed too. Interesting to remember that for next year. And we just have a few minutes left before we have to take a break, so I'm going to head way back over to the day book with our history of today on July 8th. And it says here that International History Today's highlight, on July 8th of 2018, divers rescued 4 of the 12 boys who had been trapped in a flooded cave in northern Thailand with their soccer coach for more than 2 weeks. We can remember that happened pretty vividly. Also, area history, in 1926, workers digging gravel on the Wiley Fowler Farm, 5 miles north of Penfield, unearthed an entire skeleton buried 3 feet deep. Because the land is one of the county's first settlements, many speculated that the bones could be those of an early pioneer or even more ancient inhabitant. But suppositions are wrong, because Professor F.C. Baker, the curator of the Natural History Museum at the University of Illinois, has determined that the remains are those of a middle-aged woman buried within the past 50 years. And we are going to take a break and return with the second half of our News Gazette dated July 8th in just a moment.